This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last week, the doors closed for the last time at Rockingham Park. That's been happening at racetracks across the country. Thoroughbred racing at Rockingham became a diminished thing in 2009. Since then, horse players could only watch simulcasts on TV and bet on races that were happening at other tracks. But not so very long ago, at least not so long ago if you've got some years on you, the Thoroughbred racetrack just across the Massachusetts line in Salem, New Hampshire, was an excellent take on a summer's day.
Just to stand in that railing and see them flying and the dirt flying and the colorful silks, there is nothing more exciting in the world.
That's Robert Temple. He's written two books about horse racing in New England, where there used to be 17 racetracks, and now there are none.
Just to show you how popular the sport was, in 1958, just four of those tracks, Narragansett Park, Lincoln Downs in Rhode Island, Rockingham Park, Salem, New Hampshire, Suffolk Downs, and East Boston. Just those four tracks alone outdrew the Red Sox, Bruins, and Celtics combined.
Of those four, Rockingham Park was by far the prettiest.
The other New England tracks were really kind of seedy.
Andrew Beyer, one of the nation's most celebrated turf riders, has written four books on horse racing and handicapping.
Rockingham was really a lovely place, fan-friendly, a nice environment, a really pleasant place to be, and it gave me a kind of a little bit of a different feeling about what the live horse racing experience could be.
Beyer's memories are not only the same as Robert Temple's, they're the same as mine. Rockingham Park had flower gardens. Sometimes it had bands. And, of course, as Robert Temple recalls, it had the excitement of horses rounding the final turn and coming into the stretch. That's pretty much the way I saw the Rock a little over 40 years ago when I first moved to New England. And there was this young woman who'd done some riding in horse shows when she was a kid, and I thought she might like to watch that dirt flying and the jockeys in their colorful silks, and who knows, maybe I'd pick a winner or two, which might be impressive. So we drove up from Boston to Rockingham Park. The flowers were there, and a band, I think, unless I'm only imagining that now, and there were lots of people, too, which is another respect in which my memories are similar to those of Andrew Beyer.
Racetracks were really colorful places. They had a vibrant social life filled with the types of characters that you see in Damon Runyon stories.
If you don't know any Damon Runyon stories, do yourself a favor and pick up a collection of his short fiction at the library, or Google him if you like, and you'll learn that some of those characters were touts. Those are guys who buttonhole patrons at the paddock or at the rail and give them betting advice, tips. And the touts keep track of which tips they've given to which patrons, and then if their picks pan out, they come back after the patrons have been to the window for their cash, and the touts suggest that maybe they should be tipped for their tips. One of those guys at Rockingham Park on that summer afternoon 40-odd years ago pegged me for a teacher. Maybe it was the corduroy jacket or the horn rims. Anyway, he said, "You look like a teacher." And my companion laughed because the tout was right. As I recall, I took some of his advice, and his horses showed nothing, so the tout never reappeared, and probably my companion laughed again. Maybe I lost that day. Maybe I broke even. However it worked out, the afternoon can't have entirely disappointed the young woman. We've been married for almost 35 years, and I have no regrets at all, except, of course, that now we can't go back to Rockingham Park. The NFL is back. Our long national nightmare has begun again. That's where we'll begin on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. Joining me this time around are Shira Springer of the Boston Globe and ESPN's Don Van Natta. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Don, we're going to start with you and the aforementioned NFL. Go ahead.
Well, the 2016 NFL season kicked off Thursday night. It was a rematch of Super Bowl 50. Was decided by 1 point, and there were troubling questions about whether the NFL's new concussion protocol was followed after Panthers quarterback Cam Newton suffered a helmet-to-helmet hit in the fourth quarter but didn't leave the game. The broadcast was a microcosm of everything we love and are perhaps made to feel uncomfortable about the unstoppable, indestructible NFL. And, you know, Will Leach in New York Magazine this week had a terrific piece that argues by staying silent on so many controversies, Roger Goodell and the NFL have managed to do just fine and weather PR storm after PR storm. Leach's piece raises the larger question about if, not necessarily when, the league will ever see any erosion in its popularity. So the question is, will any of the bad headlines ever make Americans stop caring about professional football? Or put another way, do all of those bad headlines actually help fuel the NFL's popularity?
Well, I still remain firmly in the when, not if camp. However, I think that the timeline is not 10 or 15 or 20 years. I think we're looking at a 50 or 60 year timeline. When you start to have a groundswell of parents of potential youth football players really saying, no, my son is not going to play football, it will happen, and it'll happen from the bottom up.
This past week, gigantic, potentially gigantic lawsuit against Pop Warner and some of the other youth football leagues. And if that does, in fact, become a class action suit, then that is going to dry up sooner rather than later. Don, I would take issue with just one thing you said. Troubling questions about the NFL concussion protocol? No. There are no questions. The protocol is a public relations gimmick and ongoing. We shouldn't expect anybody to be subject to it unless they are third-string people who have wandered onto the field by mistake. Don, have we changed your initial approach or attitude in any way?
No, I'm sorry, guys. I mean, I hear what Shira is saying, and I think 50 to 60 years is the minimum that we'll see an erosion in popularity. As long as the game is hardwired to the must-see TV culture of the United States, nostalgia, fantasy sports, gambling, you know, even patriotism, I think we'll see the league's revenues and ratings continue to skyrocket. People just love the game, and I don't see any end to the party.
I would like to turn the discussion towards college football. I recently finished reading a terrific book titled Unsportsmanlike Conduct by Jessica Luther, in which the author writes about how the worst aspects of the culture of college football may be changed. She says, among other things, that coaches, athletic directors, and university presidents have got to take responsibility for their part in creating and sustaining a culture, an environment in which players feel entitled to break the law and get away with harassment, assault, and even rape. I bring this up this week because former Baylor head coach Art Briles apologized to victims of sexual assault by players that Briles was coaching at Baylor. He seemed to acknowledge, at least in part, his failure as a leader in that context. And I'm just wondering if maybe Briles is not simply campaigning for another job. Maybe his acknowledgement, quote, "I did wrong," indicates a glimmering little bit of a light of progress. I don't know. I like to think so. Don, what do you think?
I'm far more cynical than you.
I was afraid of that.
I'm right there with you, Don. I'm right there with you.
I had to put it out there. What can I tell you?
To me, he didn't go nearly far enough for what the sins were here. And it just felt like a, you know, an engineered first step of a contrition tour to get another job. I didn't believe it. The sincerity and the authenticity of his statement just didn't register for me. I think Briles has got, you know, more apologizing to do before any of us are going to believe him.
I agree with you completely, Don. This is all about rehabilitation and getting his next job. I mean, listen, he's 60 years old. He knows he doesn't have a lot of time to waste before he can go and pursue or be pursued for another head coaching job. And you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if next fall at this time we are talking about him as the head coach of a major Division I program somewhere in the country.
The only thing that made me feel this might be the real thing, he didn't say, "I apologize if I've offended anybody." He apologized directly to the victims of the assaults and the rapes. And that, to me, is a little, just a tiny little bit different from what a lot of these other folks have done in similar positions.
True.
So
I'm
just inclined to mention that. Shira, you have returned recently from the Olympics in Rio, and I understand you are still thinking about some of the games that were being played there.
Yeah, I'm thinking about them, but I'm not sure many people around the country are thinking about them, and that's the Paralympics. They're going on right now in Rio de Janeiro, and despite hopes for a record-setting TV audience this time around, the Paralympics are very much an afterthought in the sports world. But it doesn't have to be that way. Why not hold the Paralympics before the Olympics? It makes sense on from a practical perspective and from a promotional perspective. On the practical side, there are roughly 6,000 fewer athletes from 40 fewer countries competing in about 6 fewer sports. So with the Paralympics first, organizers could see how the venues, the security checkpoints, the transportation, the food supply, signage, etc., all works. On the promotional side, I don't think there's any event in sports that's tougher to follow than the Olympics.
Don, you like flipping the two spectacles?
I think it's a no-brainer. I love the idea, as Shira pointed out, and her great column laying it out, I think, makes just an excellent argument for it. And I was stunned. Well, maybe I wasn't stunned. Maybe I was not surprised that the IOC said, we like things just as they are.
They're getting rich.
That's right. How do they justify that, Shira? That was one question I had. It makes no sense.
I'm right there with you. It's such a no-brainer. It's so frustrating talking about it because the sports are great. The competition is compelling. And the world should be watching, and it's not.
Also, practically speaking, the Paralympics have to go up, as you pointed out, against the opening of the college and pro football season here in the United States, the Premier League in the UK, and soccer leagues all over Europe. If it's in late July or early August, it's a deader time on the sports calendar, too. So it makes sense from that perspective.
Maybe staging the Paralympics first would make a difference. My guess is that the two spectacles appeal to two different and separate audiences, and I don't really know if changing the order would make a big difference. Shira, I just don't understand why you're not still there in Brazil. That's my only question.
Well, actually, I would have loved to have stayed.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been ESPN's Don Van Natta and Boston Globe's Shira Springer. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Bill.
There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. D'Artagnan Crockett's early life was bleak. His mother died when he was 8 years old. His father was an addict. By the time D'Artagnan was a sophomore in high school, he was sleeping on friends' couches. And, oh yeah, D'Artagnan is legally blind.
Being a black kid in the city with physical limitations, or what people call a disability, you're already written off. No one expects much from you. You're basically useless. And I wasn't in a position where I could fix that.
D'Artagnan's story is a Paralympic story. Those games are going on right now in Rio. But before becoming a Paralympian, D'Artagnan would become part of a new family. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
D'Artagnan Crockett couldn't change his circumstances, so he did the only thing he could. He tried to hide them. D'Artagnan's severely nearsighted, but he had just enough sight to get by, so he pretended he could see. He joined his high school wrestling team and didn't even tell the coaches.
They had no idea. I was looking at something and I was having a hard time seeing it. It was like, what's going on there? I'm like, oh, I'm visually impaired. The coach was like, you what? I didn't want them to know.
D'Artagnan didn't want the coaches to treat him any differently, so they didn't. Then one day, during senior year, Leroy Sutton joined the wrestling team at Lincoln West High School in Cleveland. D'Artagnan was one of the team captains, and he wasn't the least bit worried that his team's new recruit was missing something. Well, two somethings.
We were talking in the cafeteria, and I asked him what happened to his legs. And he told me that, yeah, I was run over by a train. And I laughed. Like one of those deep belly laughs. You had always heard the, oh, my God, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, how'd that happen? Just to see someone not feeling sorry for him just kind of sparked a bond almost instantly.
Good thing, because when the bus showed up on a snowy day to take the team to their first wrestling match of the season, it wasn't wheelchair accessible.
I told him, like, hey, jump in my bag. We'll do this.
Soon, D'Artagnan was carrying Leroy on and off buses, up and down stairs and into the bleachers. Leroy weighed about 170 pounds, but D'Artagnan didn't think much of it. He certainly didn't think it would change his life.
It was just helping out a friend, which, I mean, who wouldn't?
But there was something Leroy Sutton didn't know about D'Artagnan Crockett.
Nah, I didn't know he was blind. I found out in class I noticed he was, like, really close to the book that we were reading. So I was like, all right, yeah, it's a problem seeing. So I turned to a couple of the other students around me, and I was like, hey, man, let's do this, like, a project style and, you know, read out loud.
And that's probably how things would have stayed. D'Artagnan and Leroy helping each other out, both thinking it was no big deal. If not for an ESPN features producer named Lisa Finn and her dad. Early one morning in February of 2009, Lisa's dad called. He woke her up and told her to check out a story in the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
And there was a photograph of two high school wrestlers. One of them was riding on the back of the other because he had no legs. I was just completely in awe of this photograph. There was just something about the expression on Leroy's face in particular.
Lisa rushed to work to convince her boss, his name was Victor, to send her to Cleveland right away to film Leroy and D'Artagnan in what was likely to be their last high school wrestling match. And all she had was this photograph.
He said something to the effect of, are they good wrestlers? And I said, probably not, knowing the high school that they went to. Are they friends? Kind of looks like it. One's on the other's back. Are they articulate? Victor, I said, look at this picture. Like, it's the one who can't walk being carried by the one who can't see. And Victor's a good man. And he just looked at me and said, have a nice trip to Cleveland.
Lisa headed to the airport. She had already packed a bag. During the drive, she found a camera crew that could meet her in Cleveland and called the school. She arrived during warm-ups. But before she could introduce herself to Leroy and D'Artagnan, she was stopped by their coach.
He said, hey, you the ESPN lady? And I said, yes, I am. And I extended my hand, introduced myself, and he playfully slapped it away. And he leaned in and looked me in the eye. And he said, you have been sent here by God. You know that? He said, did you hear me? He said, you've been sent here by God today. And he said this year he'd been praying really hard for D'Artagnan and for Leroy because he felt once they graduate, the world had nothing for kids like them.
D'Artagnan was excited to talk to Lisa. He told me he felt it was about time that someone noticed him for something he was doing right. But Leroy just put in his earbuds and stared at the floor.
I was so surprised. In 13 years, the first time I'd ever been with an amateur athlete or a teenager who was not excited to see ESPN.
What Lisa didn't know yet, but would find out later, is that when Leroy was run over by a train on his way to school at the age of 11, the local paper followed him for a year and ran a 6-page spread under the headline, Comeback Kid. The paper didn't mention some of the things their reporters must have seen, that Leroy's mom wasn't taking him to his physical therapy appointments or even making sure he made it to school. She was spending his disability checks on drugs.
So I was like, whatever, I'm not trying to be in the spotlight or not trying to get any, you know, pity or praise for being in the chair. You know, it's my life.
Lisa knew that if she wanted to tell this story, she'd need Leroy's help. So she asked a coach, the one who had told her she was sent by God, to go with her to visit Leroy at his grandmother's house. Leroy was sitting on the floor of his basement room playing video games. And again, he wouldn't even look at her.
So for about an hour, I just made conversation with his coach and we left. I went back by myself the next night. Again, I sat beside him on the floor this time, and again, he wouldn't speak to me. Not any more than a grunt, anyway. I asked a few questions. And so I left. I came back a third night, same thing. And on the fourth night, I said to him, Leroy, I want to thank you for letting me visit you these last 4 days. I can tell it's not easy for you, so I'm not going to come back. But I think somewhere deep inside you have a lot to say. And I think it's probably important.
She was like, if, you know, you want to tell your story or even if you just want to talk to me as a friend, then I'll be here for you.
My heart was really heavy as I went up the stairs because I feared that if I left, no one may ever find him again. But as I got to the front door, I heard him coming up the stairs and he called out to me and he just sort of gruffly said,
hey, I got this new game. You wanna see it? And then she watched me play a game.
It felt really good. Not because I had won anything, but because I know how difficult it is for trauma victims to trust, and he certainly didn't fully trust me, but he was willing to take a chance.
So Lisa set out to tell Leroy and D'Artagnan's story for ESPN. She interviewed her subjects and researched their backgrounds. She maintained proper journalistic distance from the two teenagers, even though she did buy them dinner at Subway after their shoots. Until one day when she discovered that she couldn't be just an observer anymore. It was at the conference powerlifting championships.
D'Artagnan was in the process of winning the whole thing when he went to the bleachers to rest, I guess.
Actually, people were saying how stuff was stolen, and we went over to check, and a lot of our things were stolen.
So his wallet, his ID, his phone, his duffel bag, everything he had.
I even had my social security card in it because I didn't know where else to put it.
And he went into a full-on rage, like where he looked capable of violence.
I completely went ballistic. Because when you grow up with nothing and you have nothing, having something stolen from you is a huge thing.
Lisa offered to help D'Artagnan replace his things, and D'Artagnan accepted. But she'd need cash. So she turned to her cameraman, his name was Cameron, and asked if she could borrow some money.
And he kind of rolled his eyes at me and let out a big sigh, and he said, go save the turtles.
Turtles. Okay, hang with me here. Lisa was about to do something journalists aren't supposed to do. She was going to affect the outcome of her story. And that's not a good idea for the story, for the reporter, and sometimes even for the people being interviewed. But here's the thing. Have you ever found yourself watching a video and something really awful is happening and no one is doing anything to stop it? For Cameron, it was watching nature films about baby sea turtles trying to survive their short walk from the sand to the sea.
And Cameron said, and then it hits you. Sea turtles would not be endangered if the cameraman would just pick them up and throw them in the ocean. And he said, these boys wouldn't be struggling if we helped them. So go. Go. Cross that sacred line of journalistic ethics. Here's $200. Go save the turtles.
Lisa shot 120 hours of video, about 100 hours more than normal. She spent 2 months editing. That's a job that usually takes 2 weeks.
At Lincoln West High School in Cleveland, senior wrestlers D'Artagnan Crockett and Leroy Sutton are a team of their own. Inseparable, joined together at more than the hip.
ESPN aired the story in August of 2009. Leroy called D'Artagnan as soon as it was over.
The conversation was just, dude, I know, right? Yeah.
It was just grunts and dudes. It was very short.
Because, I mean, there was nothing else that we needed to say. Because everything was said in the story. We both just understood that it was powerful.
D'Artagnan and Leroy didn't yet know how much power was in their story, but Lisa was starting to find out.
Whew. I had spent that whole edit period sort of praying that just one person would see it and want to help them. And that was a really small prayer. Because within minutes of the story airing, I was started getting 2-3 emails a minute from people who saw it and wanted to help.
Soon, there was money for college. So Lisa helped Leroy and D'Artagnan make it through their entrance exams and college applications. She took them shopping for school supplies. Leroy moved to Phoenix to study video game development at Collins College of Design. And D'Artagnan attended school in Colorado while training with the Paralympic judo team in Colorado Springs. Lisa thought her job was done, but it was just beginning.
You know, I had put them on television as these resilient sort of action figure hero friends that I saw and that I believed they still were. But now I was dealing with essentially preteens in terms of the life skills that they had.
Leroy and D'Artagnan struggled in school. Lisa had them both tested and found that their skills were far below grade level. Lisa taught them how to write up a budget, but they still ran out of money almost as soon as it was deposited in their bank accounts. To hear Leroy and D'Artagnan tell it, it wasn't that bad. Leroy says the schoolwork was easy. It was just the organizational skills he was lacking. And D'Artagnan admits that training with the Paralympic team was stressful, but it was nothing like the stress of wondering where he'd be sleeping the next night. But everyone agrees that the stakes were high.
They needed to stay afloat because there was no plan B. They had nowhere to go back to. They had no family to go back to. They had no saving account to fall back on. They had no education to fall back on. It broke my heart.
Slowly, things started to improve. D'Artagnan figured out how to get to practice on time. And somehow, just 2 years after arriving at the Olympic Training Center, he qualified to compete in judo at the London Paralympics.
I started 2 years late. Reality, I started 18 years too late. And so the idea of me making a Paralympic team just seemed sort of impossible.
Lisa and Leroy flew to London to cheer D'Artagnan on. And then?
He did it. It was amazing.
He won the bronze.
He did.
And what was that moment like?
Well, now you're going to make me cry. It was unbelievable. And I say this a lot, but it was like watching this boy who had spent his life largely forgotten by this world. As his coach said, nothing for him in this life. And now he was standing on the top of a Paralympic podium with a medal around his neck. It was just one of the most stirring, powerful, redemptive images I have ever witnessed.
The USOC gives American medal winners the opportunity to give a medal to the person they feel is most responsible for getting them to the podium. It's called the Order of Ecos, and it's supposed to go to a coach.
I, of course, gave it to Lisa. There was no one else to consider.
He hung this medal around my neck and gave me a big hug and thanked me for all I had done. That was a moment of love.
It felt really great to see how appreciative and grateful she was to receive an award or gift, whatever you want to call it, from me.
Back home in Phoenix, Leroy was struggling. His girlfriend had given birth to his daughter, but the stresses of school and finances and being a dad were too much for him. He was diagnosed with PTSD. Leroy saw a therapist for a while, but then he decided that he didn't want to talk to a stranger. He wanted to talk to Lisa.
What he needed most in that moment was, again, just as I did in the basement 3 years prior, someone to sit beside him and wait and listen.
Things started to look up for Leroy. He would eventually graduate from college and get a job as a video game tester. Yes, he plays video games for a living. But before all that, he started a tradition. In May of 2013, he wrote Lisa a letter for Mother's Day. When I asked him why he did it, it was almost like he didn't understand why I needed to ask.
Because she feels like my mom. It's like, hey, she deserves this. See, I did it.
That letter is printed in Lisa's new book. I was hoping Leroy would read it out loud for me, and he said he had a copy on his phone.
Nope, that one's not on my phone. I have the one from this year, though.
Can you read some of that to me? Is that okay?
Sure. Actually, it's kind of weird, so I could email it to you.
I thought Leroy was hesitating because he didn't want to share something so personal. This is the guy who made Lisa sit, staring at him, while he played video games for 4 consecutive nights before he'd even speak to her. So I was surprised when it showed up in my inbox just a few minutes later. It's a poem, and part of it goes like this. When I first met you, those were dark days. In that time, I was stuck in my dark way. There was no light, so you set the world ablaze. But now these days, I'm full of smile, full of play. Hope you feel loved today. So I take this moment to say, thank you, Mom. I love you.
I had never gone through these things with Leroy and D'Artagnan expecting a thank you or acknowledgement. It wasn't why I was in this. You know, when people ask me what surprises me about our story, I say it's that they loved me back.
That's Lisa Fenn speaking to Only a Game's Karen Given. Lisa's new book is called Carry On, A Story of Resilience, Redemption, and an Unlikely Family, and it's available now. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Next week on the podcast, a story of baseball and murder in Depression-era Detroit. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, saddle up for a ride back to 1976 on the stubborn creature that won the Great American Horse Race. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NFL season began on Thursday night with a rematch of Denver and Carolina, the teams who faced each other in the last Super Bowl. Is it fair to say that the story to emerge from that game was the league's apparent unwillingness to enforce one of its own very important rules?
Yeah, this game set back the NFL's PR campaign on head injuries back to about 1966. I will not waver from my conviction that Denver went after Cam Newton's head, particularly in the fourth quarter, one incredibly egregious example that should have gotten somebody thrown out, and then was determined to be an offsetting penalty with an intentional grounding call that occurred, I think, only because Cam Newton was being beheaded by the Denver player. This was a disgrace for the NFL, which didn't need another one on this in this context.
Yeah, for me, the real story here is the various levels of people who are supposed to notice when somebody suffers a serious head knock and a potential brain injury. They're supposed to take him out and look at him.
Actually, the really bad thing is they actually evaluated him before he went out to do this post-game interview, and he said he didn't remember the end of the game.
He said he didn't remember who asked him questions and what questions they asked.
Yeah,
either.
It's really time for him to take next week off.
Has this NFL flap overshadowed the previous NFL flap, which is Colin Kaepernick's refusal to stand for the national anthem before the 49ers
game? Oh, no, because it's starting to spread to other teams.
And other sports.
Yes, and given the fact that the first big Sunday of NFL football happens to be the 15th anniversary of 9/11, we're going to be roasting in hot take hell for the next week, probably. But there are people lining up with him, and I think John Tortorella, the coach of the United States hockey team, is an idiot. But
he's the one who said, if any of my players sit for the national anthem, they'll sit for the game as well.
Yeah.
I won't put them on the ice.
I would, like, pay substantial bribes if I had any money to get both of his goalies to sit during the national anthem. Go ahead, John, big guy.
Let's see what you can do without a goalkeeper.
Yeah, let's see what you got now.
Charlie, my favorite source for sports gambling information, the American Gaming Association.
Which I still love, by the way.
I do, too.
I am so glad
there's
a trade group.
Anyway, they claimed this week that $90 billion will be bet during the NFL season, and $88 billion of that will be bet illegally. Do you suppose the AGA has a motive in reporting these figures?
I suspect that maybe they're just trying to make it obvious that illegal sports betting is a genie that's been out of the bottle for quite several decades. I'd like to be like vice president for marketing for the American Gaming Association. You must meet such wonderful people.
This week, Kimberly Archie and Joe Cornell sued Pop Warner Football. The litigants are mothers of sons who played Pop Warner and died very young and suffered, as it turned out, from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is, of course, more commonly associated with older players employed by the NFL. If this becomes a class action suit, which is a possibility, is youth football over?
I think youth football is over in a lot of places, yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody should be playing tackle football before they're 16 anyway.
Pop Warner kids start at 5.
Yeah, I mean, this is ridiculous. You want them to learn basically what a 5-year-old has to know about football? Let them play flag football. But it's absurd that a 24-year-old kid dies and in his autopsy, he's already got CTE. That's ridiculous.
In baseball news, the New York Mets have signed a promising young player to a minor league deal. Who's the prospect at the center of that story?
He can't play this game either! It's Tim Tebow.
Not at the highest level.
Not at the minor league level.
We'll see.
However, I would be staying on my toes if I was sitting anywhere near the box seats in whatever minor league field he plays in, because you will be getting at least one souvenir baseball. I guarantee it.
This weekend's Basketball Hall of Fame enshrinement will include, among others, Shaquille O'Neal, Cheryl Swoops, Yao Ming, and Allen Iverson, who kicked off the festivities by arriving late. What, he thought it was a practice?
I don't know. I'm so happy for him, though. I mean, he really deserves to be there. This is a great class. The photo of Shaquille O'Neal and Yao Ming is great because for the first time ever, Shaquille O'Neal looks like a little guy. I'd forgotten how big Yao Ming really is.
And finally, Charlie, a new U.S. record was set at Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia.
Sports!
It happened a week and a half ago, but it's going to deserve mention anyway, even though we're late. What happened?
Bruce Springsteen broke the U.S. record for longest rock concert, 4 hours and 4 minutes, the E Street Band record anyway. The longest show, by the way, is one that he did in Helsinki in 2012, which was 2 minutes longer, which is one more chorus of Sherry Darling.
Yeah, but you know, it seems to me, and my senior producer agrees with me on this, that probably the Grateful Dead staged any number of concerts that were much longer than this, but just nobody remembers.
I was going to say, there isn't a single reliable witness to any of them, including the band.
You can find
the next time we get Walton in here, you should ask him about that.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Our next story is about America, a birthday party, a father and son, and a one-of-a-kind sporting event that ended 40 years ago last week. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has more.
The year was 1976. Don't Go Breaking My Heart by Elton John and Kiki D was on the radio. The movie Rocky was a surprise hit, and
people were looking for a party.
That's Kurt Lewis. In 1976, he had just finished his journalism degree at Wichita State.
You know, Vietnam's just over in 75. You know, Watergate was over, Nixon was gone, and everyone was looking for a good time.
And there was an excuse to celebrate.
Happy birthday, Uncle
ABC News goes to the Great American Birthday Party.
The U.S. was turning 200, and that birthday party seemed to last all year. In honor of the bicentennial, trains and airplanes were painted red, white, and blue. A fleet of tall ships sailed down the Hudson River. And there was a horse race unlike any other. It was called the Great American Horse Race, and it would span nearly 100 days and 3,500 miles, starting in New York, heading to Missouri, and then
trying to follow the Pony Express route from St. Joe on.
Kurt Lewis was hired by the race organizers to document all the greatness and Americanness of the Great American Horse Race, and also the competition. The rider who covered the distance fastest would get $25,000, worth about $100,000 in today's dollars. About 100 riders signed up. Cowboys took a break from rodeos. World War II veterans, finished with their missions on submarines and B-17 bombers, also entered. So did a sheriff, and even an Austrian count.
Count Johannes Hoyas. And he was a good guy.
And then there was Verl Norton. He was one of the oldest riders. He didn't have as big a bank account as most of the others. He didn't have any fancy horse equipment or a big crew to help him set up camp or cook or do laundry. But he had a plan. See, while some riders entered Icelandic ponies, quarter horses, and Appaloosas, the consensus was the horse to ride, if you wanted to win, was an Arabian.
The sport of endurance horse riding is won by Arabian horses. The motto, if you're not riding an Arabian, you're following an Arabian.
But Verl Norton was going to challenge that motto. It was the Great American Horse Race, but Verl Norton entered a mule.
He always had a hankering for mules, I think, maybe from his childhood.
That's Verl's son, Pierce. Most of the riders had a crew of two or three to help along the race. Verl only had Pierce, and Pierce was only 16.
I had just gotten my driver's license in March. Guess I had to learn how to drive pretty fast.
Even with a mule and a crew of one teenager, Verl Norton was confident that he was going to win.
He was quite a social, charismatic guy, and we'd go into a restaurant and he'd start talking about it, and he wouldn't kind of hold back his confidence, and I would kind of be a little sheepish back there thinking, well, we need to see what's going to happen here.
So why did Verl Norton have such confidence in his mule and his 16-year-old son? Let's back up a little bit. Verl Norton was born in Wyoming in 1916. As a teenager, he caught and trained wild horses. He and his family also worked mules on their farm.
And so he had an understanding of what the strengths and weaknesses of mules were.
Verl learned that mules are slow, generally not a good quality for a race. But he also learned that mules have stamina and durability, good qualities for the 3,500-mile Great American Horse Race. Verl got married and settled in San Jose, California. He worked as a steeplejack. He went around the country painting tall things like towers and smokestacks. And he had a family.
There was five of us children and my mother, and then my dad would be out, you know, painting, and he'd be in Sacramento or North Dakota or someplace, and he'd come home every couple weeks. When I was about 8 years old, my mom got breast cancer and got pretty ill. And all of us kids, since my father wasn't there all the time, we got shipped off to some relatives in Idaho and Wyoming. We were all with different relatives.
Pierce ended up in Idaho.
I went up to my Uncle DeLosses, who had a cattle ranch and farm, and he had six kids there himself and a two-bedroom house. You know, you're getting up in the morning feeding cows and things like that. It's a completely different life. When I first went up there, I think kind of the pretense was, this is a temporary thing. We're going to go up until my mother gets better. Now, that's what I understood as an eight-year-old kid. So I was at my Uncle DeLosses' house, and he got a phone call. This was in May of 69 when my mother died, and that was the phone call. And that kind of, I mean, I think I became an adult right there. Everything became clear. I'm on my own at this point.
Pierce and his siblings stayed with relatives. Meantime, Verl sold the family's home in San Jose to pay off hospital bills. He moved into a house trailer on the family ranch outside of town. But unlike his siblings, Pierce didn't adjust well to his new setting.
I never quite fit in and became one of the family.
So when Pierce was 12, his father came to get him. Pierce moved on to the ranch with his dad.
He had another house trailer there right next door, and so I lived in my own house trailer from the time I went down there at 12 years old. So he would seriously be gone for a month or more at a time, and I would just take care of the ranch and myself and get to school and cook my meals and do my laundry and whatever else had to be done. It didn't seem strange to me. It probably seemed strange to other people.
Which is to say that by the time Verl Norton saw the ad for the Great American Horse Race in the magazine Western Horseman, 16-year-old Pierce was well-prepared to be his dad's crew. So Verl and Pierce set out from California for the starting line in New York in a 1971 Dodge pickup with loose steering, hauling a camper in a low-end horse trailer that didn't have any horses in it. What it did carry was Lord Fauntleroy, nicknamed Leroy, and a backup mule named Lady Eloise. On May 31st, 1976, the Great American Horse Race began. The race was structured like the Tour de France. There was a set course for each day, usually about 35 miles, and the riders were clocked at the start and finish. At first, Verl's strategy didn't pay off.
There was people going full blast the first day, you know, probably rode twice as fast as my dad did. Sooner or later, you start to wonder, well, you know, I wonder if this is a good strategy. Like, you know, I'm thinking, well, if these guys keep it up, there's no way to be able to make up this time.
But here's another thing you need to know about the Great American Horse Race, and maybe you've been wondering this. Veterinarians accompanied the group, and there were mandatory checks throughout the day. If a horse, or mule, showed any signs of breaking down, even if it just wasn't walking right, the horse, or mule, would have to ride in the trailer until it was healthy again. And that meant penalty time for the riders. So as the days went on, more and more horses started breaking down, and more riders started getting penalty time. And that wasn't the only thing slowing some teams.
Plenty of drinking on this thing, and, you know, people up the middle of the night screaming and hollering and fighting and where's my girlfriend, that sort of thing.
That's Kurt Lewis again. And while other competitors were getting into trouble, Lewis says Pierce was...
absolutely positively focused. I mean, he was busy all the time. He was doing things. It was a full-time job to do everything he had to do. Do laundry, shopping, groceries, cook, and all that sort of thing.
And with a focused crew and a healthy ride, sure enough,
they had a begrudging respect for the mule sooner or later.
Because about a quarter of the way into the race, in Kankakee, Illinois, Verl Norton and Leroy went out ahead of all the Arabians.
He'd always said that he hadn't planned on taking the lead that early. So everybody ran their horses down a little bit sooner than he thought, I guess. You know, as soon as we got into the lead, there's a long ways to go, but it was, you know, we're going in the right direction. It was like the lead was getting longer.
And so days before the finish, it became clear that a mule was going to win the Great American Horse Race. And on the last day,
there was a whole bank of press photographers there, you know, and it was just these cameras flashing and going off like crazy. Some of the other competitors put my dad up on their shoulders and ran him around the fairgrounds there a little bit. I don't know if we ever really had like a kind of a moment where we did a high five or anything. He wasn't that kind of guy. He could just look over and nod at me, and I would know that he was satisfied with the job that I did.
Winning the race got Verl Norton into newspapers and on TV. It earned him respect among his horse-loving friends for the rest of his life. For Pierce, there was no fame. When the race was over, he went back to high school. He's a scientist now, and he says he hasn't ridden a horse or a mule in 20 years. But the Great American Horse Race remains special.
You know, I'm 56 years old now, and in the 40 years since that race happened, there's not a bigger event in my life.
Verl Norton died in 1995. 2 years before he passed, Verl got to relive some of the race through a book co-authored by Kurt Lewis. And today, Pierce Norton remembers his father fondly.
I come to appreciate some stuff kind of later on. My dad raised me kind of on his own. And his best attribute, I think, is he could get more out of a person than they thought they could give. He would give you an opportunity to prove to yourself that, you know, you were good.
And in 1976, Verl and Pierce Norton and their mule Leroy proved to America that they weren't just good, they were great.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. To read more about the race, check out Atlas Obscura's recent story, The 1976 Great American Horse Race Was Won by a Mule Named Lord Fauntleroy. You can link to it at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from horse racing expert Robert Temple.
Joey Lewis, the comedian, used to say, "I follow the horses, but the horses I follow the horses."
And after them come the horses I followed. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.